Thank you to Red Eye, the Photography Network, for partnering with us to produce Season 3 of the Photo Ethics Podcast. Red Eye is a not-for-profit organization with a strong ethical focus, offering support and opportunities to help you advance your photography and your career. Find out more at redeye.org.uk. Welcome to Season 3 of the Photo Ethics Podcast. I'm your host, Savannah Dodd, and I'm the founder of the Photography Ethics Center. Each week, I'll be talking with an accomplished photographer about the ethics of their practice. Today, in episode number 6, we'll be talking with Tara Todras-Whitehill about becoming a storyteller. Tara Todras-Whitehill is an award-winning visual storyteller with photos on more than 20 front pages of the New York Times. With her decade of experience as a working photojournalist and a founder of two creative agencies, she now also helps organizations maximize their impact by ethically elevating their visual storytelling skills. She does this through a combination of consulting, bespoke workshops, and photo-video mentoring sessions. Her goal is to help people and organizations change the world through their stories. Could we just start with you telling me a little bit about the type of work that you do?
Yeah, sure. So I live in Istanbul. I work globally as a photojournalist and visual storyteller. And I moved to the Middle East over 15 years ago now, which is kind of crazy to say, to work on women-related issues. I wanted to explore and kind of be able to amplify the voices of women who were working on issues that were problematic for women, like, you know, women's reproductive health, and explain and show those, but also then show the things that were happening that were changing the world around them, changing their communities, and being able to essentially change the world through that. So that was kind of what I started in, and it's grown from there, obviously, to be a lot more. And sometimes I get to work on those issues, and sometimes I don't, but there's a lot of like work to be done in just helping people's voices to be heard in photography and video and audio, essentially everything that's storytelling.
Okay, great. So you work really across a variety of mediums then.
Yeah, I do. And I also now am training people to be storytellers as well. So I do everything. I do everything from the photo and video to the audio to getting the assets. And that was mostly pre-pandemic, right? So I haven't done as much in the pandemic. And then I have, this is my second creative agency. So I have my first one where I did a lot of work project management of running projects for different NGOs to help them create their media products. And then I still do that. And now I also train people. So I'm doing a lot of different things, but I feel like they're all really important in the digital storytelling world, you know, because like I want to be able to take photos, but I also think it's unfair and not right that we're the only ones doing it if well, right? Because I mean, I'm sure most photographers can relate to this. They're on an assignment and someone says where you are, oh, you should have been here last week. There was this amazing event. And then they like show you a picture on their phone of the back of someone's head at a rally or whatever, at a festival. And you're like, oh, well, that sounded wonderful, but we can't use that photo and it's not really like a great photo. Those people should be empowered to tell their stories effectively. And it's not the kind of thing where having people come in and tell it professionally is important, but there's so much that is left without that. So I want people to be able to effectively tell their stories and, you know, make connections through social media and whatever, because we all can tell our stories these days. It's just how effective it is, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So I guess a lot of the training that you're doing then would be not necessarily with people who are professionals in the field, but with sort of anybody who has a story to tell, which is everybody, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I actually haven't been training photographers. I've been training researchers, comms officers who are trying to communicate to the people who are there in the communities, not necessarily also media people, you know, HR people, because like storytelling is also internal. It runs the gamut. So like I've really kind of not been focusing on people who already have some skills, but people that don't necessarily feel capable of telling their stories well or need some guidance, and just being able to, you know, elevate that. Because like there's so much out there in the social impact space, but so many times there's just so much that you don't see, and there are so many great stories, but we're not seeing them because people aren't paying attention and they're not being told in the right way.
Absolutely. And I guess thinking about your own practice as a photographer, you know, what sort of drew you to moving away? Because you're originally from New York, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
So what was it that sort of drew you to decide to tell women's stories in the Middle East specifically? And how did that evolve for you?
It's interesting. So it started actually more specific to the U.S. Over 15 years ago, did a photo essay of black and white pictures with women activists wearing a T-shirt that said, "I had an abortion." It was a very simple T-shirt, but it obviously was very powerful. And, you know, people get a lot of emotions on both sides to that. But I really just wanted their stories. So to say that and then have their stories next to them to like show those side by side was just, I thought, very effective to say, this is, you know, a person's story. We should have a conversation about this, because all I wanted to do was like provoke conversation about this issue so that both sides can kind of talk about it and see either's as human, right? But when I did that, because at that point I wasn't sure what kind of photography, I mean, I had gone to school for engineering, so I was not in like the photography space, but I was not sure what kind of photography I wanted to do. And I was really motivated by this, and I felt like the first time where I really had a purpose. And when I realized that that was what I wanted to do, I wanted to do more things where people weren't really seeing each other. And I hadn't really spent much time in the Middle East, but I just felt like that was a region where women were stereotyped, you know, especially by the Western media. So that was kind of something that I wanted to help and to be able to kind of add more stories to. So that was the impetus to moving to the Middle East. And when I moved to the Middle East, which is a very specific date because it's February 14th, 2005, was also the day that the ex-prime minister of Lebanon, Rafik Hariri, was assassinated. So I landed with the intention of being a photojournalist. And then literally 12 hours after I landed, there was a massive explosion that I was on the AUB campus at the time. You could feel like it just went through you. It was like a boom. And I had a decision to make, which was run towards the massive explosion or run away from it. And I chose to run towards it. So you could say like trial by fire is pretty accurate. And I didn't do anything with those photos. I didn't know anything about what I was even photographing at that point. Like I had no idea. And I think the person who won the World Press photo of that year was a Reuters photographer who was right on the scene. And I just had no idea. But I just realized that I was capable of being calm under pressure, and I could take photos in situations that were not necessarily tame. And that kind of started the cycle of like where I was doing. And so I was in Lebanon, and then I moved to Egypt, and then I was hired as a staff photographer by the Associated Press for 4 years. So it just kind of snowballed. And then at the point which I thought I was going to leave the region, that's when the Arab Spring happened. So then I stayed, and now, yeah, I'm in Istanbul, and I'm pretty happy living here and being able to move around the world from here.
That's such an interesting story, for sure. And there's so much to dig into in that. But that idea that, yeah, you started thinking that you're coming here to do one thing and then, you know, sort of forced into, just by virtue of the date and context that you were working with, and sort of moving into another area. That's really interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
I was really picked up very quickly by the wires because I was able to do that work. So I worked for Reuters and then I worked for AP because I was good at it. But then I realized at some point that why I had moved to the region, I wasn't doing. Because like, I didn't want to do the wire work because that wasn't my passion. I mean, I learned a lot. When I was working for Reuters and the Associated Press, you know, I was working all over the region, and it was an amazing learning experience. I covered some insane events, you know, from like the blow up of the Hamas border in Gaza to like funerals and crazy things. And it was really important work, but it wasn't the work I wanted to do. And I wasn't following what I wanted to do. So when I was staff with the Associated Press, which was, I guess, a little bit of a coup that I was even made staff without having ever worked for the AP, I quit after 4 years because I wasn't really getting what I wanted out of it. And people thought I was crazy because I was quitting a staff job. And who quits a staff job? And I was like, but this isn't what I signed up for. So then I went back to doing more in-depth storytelling for social impact, working on what I really wanted to do.
That, yeah, must have been a very hard decision to make. Or was it a very easy decision to make? I don't know.
It was hard because, you know, when you get a paycheck for 4 years, it's like hard to quit that, you know? And I had been a freelancer before, but you have a staff, you have equipment that's given to you, you have a team, and they're all awesome, and a car. I mean, like, you know, those kind of things. Yeah, I had to do all those things on my own afterwards. So that was kind of scary to go back to it. But no, it was definitely the right decision. I just wasn't happy doing the spot news or the wire service news all the time.
So you were talking about like in-depth storytelling and, you know, that you wanted to get back into sort of telling more in-depth stories. And it reminds me of something that you said at the start that I thought was really interesting, was when you were describing that photo series with the women who were wearing the t-shirt that said, "I had an abortion." I thought it was really interesting the way that you described pairing that with their story as text. And I don't know, it just makes me think a lot about the importance of context. And I guess when you're working, you know, for AP, you probably had less control potentially over the context that necessarily went with your photographs or how they were situated or how they were read by the audience as well. And I guess that would have given you a lot more control than once you left AP to tell them and present them in a way that felt right to you. Does that make sense? Does that resonate?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, I think like, even when I'm doing work for social impact organizations, there's only so much you can have control over the final product anyway, because you give stuff to people and then they do things. But that's actually why I added on training, because if you're not a storyteller at heart, you may not know the best way to put your story out there or reuse the content or like find the nuggets that like are evergreen, you know? And so I was so frustrated by all of that, like not being able to control it from, you know, the Associated Press. Obviously, people use it. They use it without captions. They use it in the wrong way. And we would go after people who did that. There was definitely times where they were told to take stuff down that was not correct. Like they were using an image and saying it was something else. But still, like, you know, it's all over the world and that's amazing. But then, you know, obviously people can do what they want with that. Anything these days is like that. But I feel like for social impact organizations, they should be able at least to control the output to an extent of where they're using it. And a lot of times with my first agency, we would give them the final product and they'd be like, okay, thanks. And then nothing. It'd be like, whew, just off into the ether. And you're like, what happened to that? Oh, well, we sent out a tweet once or, you know, oh, we did that thing. But you're like, but there's so much more you could be doing with this, right? So that was kind of also the impetus to help people understand storytelling, because then they can understand how to use those better and make the best use of all those products.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that I've heard quite a lot from people is really a miscommunication that happens a lot of times, I think, in NGOs or the nonprofit sector that sort of happens across organizations or between the photographers and the people who are then using the photographs, like what you're describing. And I think one of those things that sometimes gets a little bit lost in translation or that people have a different understanding of is ethics. Have you found that in your own in your own work?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, I think that NGOs versus journalism have very different decisions about what is correct for them. I mean, I always take the journalist ethics to the nonprofits or the social impact organizations I'm working for, but you have to always kind of figure out how to balance those things because they're working in a different context than a news organization. And you have to figure out how you can balance that and still feel good about what you're doing, but also make sure that you're not doing any harm for them. Right. So that's also something that's a learning lesson for them. And, you know, if you're new to that and you haven't worked for the nonprofit field before, then like the ethics are similar, but different enough that they can make a very big difference. And that's another thing that I've kind of been promoting through the work I'm doing essentially online now, you know, is like helping people understand when they're thinking about their brand or they're thinking about their voice, how ethical storytelling should be incorporated. And what's exciting about that is that I feel like a lot of organizations have taken this moment, or now we're talking years of the pandemic, to really think about how they are doing that and really think about how they can organically put it into their work. And so that's really exciting for me because, you know, I feel like that's so important to ethical storytelling, to photojournalism that I want to do and I want to promote. And when you get big organizations saying, yes, tell us how we can do this or how you can help us, then I'm like, that's going to trickle down because those organizations are the ones that will feed everyone else. And if they can do it, and of course, it's not easy. It takes time. It takes effort, right? But it's still important. And if they can do it, then other people can see that process.
Absolutely. And I think that there are so many ways that things trickle down too, because, you know, the way that we perceive people through photographs, if those are photographs that are made from more of a dignified or an ethical or a stance that embraces representational responsibility, us internalizing those photographs, we're going to have a very different perception about people around the world as well. So I think that there are so many levels at which this trickles down.
Yeah. And what's amazing to me is that the biggest organizations in the world still need help. It's not like they've figured it out. I'm not going to name a name, but I'm just saying, like, one of the biggest foundations in the world, I took a look at their report last year or the year before, and it was like the people who headed the organization were named and they were white. And then everyone else who was not white and not from, you know, no names throughout the entire annual report, people smiling, whatever. But it was like no names, no captions, just nameless. And then there was like a section where there was a vulnerable population that they were assisting. They didn't want to put the picture, but then they did a depiction of them. And then they showed pictures of where they lived, which were just demeaning. You know, there was nothing representative of that. There was no agency there. And I was like, so the only people you named are people that were vulnerable, that you couldn't use their photos, and then you showed their surroundings in this, you know, very stereotypical way. I was like, come on, we can all do better. And so my goal is to be able to do both, to be able to go out and represent and show that stuff on the ground. And then also, because I'm only one woman, right? And I want everyone to do it. So to amplify and multiply that, right? By giving that power to them.
Something that I've heard quite a lot as well is the sense of people saying, well, you know, it's not on us to make those changes, or we have to do things in a certain way because that's what funders want to see, or that's what gets money. And it's all for this greater good of if we can support that community, even if the photographs aren't dignified, or even if there are issues in how we're telling stories, if that's what brings in the money, then it's all justified. How do you handle those types of conversations?
It takes a while for them to get it, but it's like, we're not in a world, what people want, they want to feel like there's hope, even if the whole thing isn't hope, that there's something that you can do. So showing the things that people are powerful and that they're taking initiatives on their own or whatever, it doesn't have to be the whole thing, like, because there are big issues and I'm not downplaying them. But everyone has those things in their life, and we have to show them as humans that have all these different dimensions. And when we do, then people come back. And that's the research. If you do like the downtrodden thing and like, oh, woe is me and whatever, they don't come back because people might donate or whatever, but they're not interested in it because it makes them feel bad, which is like selfish to say, but it's true. You know, we're living in a selfie age. And so you have to understand that. So you have to give them something where they want to share, that they want to connect, that they want those things. And that's about being that human moment that we do that. So I would say that when people say that to me, and I'm like, the people that are having those connections, that are connecting with their audience, that are bringing in new people, they're not doing that in, you know, the old ways, very, very old and needs to be put away, far away in a box, in a corner. And it takes a while for sure. Like I said, there's a ton of organizations that are still doing it the old way, but it's a slow movement. And that's why it's exciting when I work with the places that will be representative to show how you can do it and how much of a difference it makes when you do it well.
Absolutely. And in your own practice as a photographer, I guess, or as an educator, either way, really, what was it that made you start thinking about these things in terms of ethics and in terms of representation? Because it does seem like it's quite a big part of how you're thinking about these things. And I guess I'm wondering if there was sort of a light bulb moment or a moment of pivoting that happened for you.
That's a really good question. I mean, I think for me, like, it was something I was internalized, but I didn't have the words for it for a while. Even that abortion project, which was one of the first things, was about people's voices and not anything, just like their picture and their stories. That's it. And that's what I wanted. But I didn't say it at that point. You know, it wasn't like, for me, crystallized. But it's always been really important, essentially, first-person narratives, where it's not a subject, it's a participant, right? Someone is a participant in the story. They're not something to be, you know, just a picture. They get to be an active role. And to me, that's telling their story, not just something that's for your own gain. I think when over the years, like the things that I had to go through, where I found what I didn't want to do and why I didn't want to do it and what was important. And then just when I left the Associated Press and was not doing, I mean, I still work for the New York Times, so I still use photojournalism, but I was doing half and half. Like, I was doing NGO work and I was doing journalism work, and I was just contemplating how people are seen in both of those. And I think that just evolved over time. And now I feel like the words are out there more. Like, there's ethicalstorytelling.com. I'm part of dignifiedstorytelling.com or Dignified Storytelling. It's obviously, that's also the website. But there are like places that are putting these things together. And you, with the Photo Ethics podcast, we're talking about these things in a way that hasn't been, I think. So it's just kind of building in steam.
Could you talk a little bit about your experience as a photojournalist and how that has maybe differed practically or in terms of ethical storytelling or sort of that idea of representation from how you find it working more with nonprofits or the charity sector?
Yeah, it's a fine line, right? Because I still view myself as a journalist and a photojournalist. So you want to make sure you're telling the story that's accurate. But you also recognize that they are working within confines, you know? If you're working with a government, there's things that they can't say. And how do you tell the story accurately so that your own ethics are being met, but that you're also not doing any harm to communities where that's like the first and foremost thing, right? You do no harm. And you don't do harm as a journalist either, but you know, like your intention in terms of telling the world the story is different than for the NGO in terms of them telling their story. Maybe, you know, it's a fine line and it's a question I'm constantly thinking about because I don't think there's an answer. And I think it's just important to be aware of it because you have to check in. You have to check in with, you know, the journalism part and you have to check in with the NGO part or the social impact part. And make sure it feels good and right and have a continual conversation with the parties involved about it, you know, because just having that being open and honest, it benefits everyone because then they can also see things that they may not have understood or might also be beneficial for them that they didn't think about before because they're just like hardwired to do certain things and tell their stories in certain ways. So
that's interesting. Yeah. And it sort of brings to light a tension, yeah, that you're describing, you know, between aims and objectives and how things are done. Because I guess at the end of the day, for charities or NGOs, it's in some ways more aligned to like commercial photography because it is sort of selling a certain story with an aim of raising profit. Well, not profit, but raising capital to invest in communities. So there are quite a lot of tensions, I guess, between yeah, that and photojournalism, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, I think it's something that I definitely would turn down things where I felt like I couldn't honor my own journalist ethics. But I haven't had that because the places I have worked with, we've had a continual conversation about those things and like what that means and just thinking about the story in a different way, even. So saying the stuff, but just saying it in a way that, you know, makes sense for everyone. I think that you just have to think about that stuff.
And what does that mean, bringing photojournalism and photojournalistic ethics to storytelling for charities and NGOs? Like, why is that a good thing for charities and NGOs? How do you sell that angle, you know?
Well, I mean, I think, like, for me, my photojournalism or my visual storytelling has always been about first person. And what I do is, like, I literally can show you side by side two different things, right? A video or a photo where the person's not there, right? This is like pictures or whatever, and they're, it's like a booming narrator voice or, you know, not in the first person. And then you put that side by side with someone just talking to you at the camera or just saying, like, this is something that's important to me and the caption. The difference is immediate, like that. Like, we all get it because we connect with the person. But if I asked 5 minutes later what that video was about, or if you remember the stats from the video, probably not. Not going to remember anything from the booming narrator voice video, because we are synced for stories, right? And we're synced for connection. So that's kind of the thing. I literally do that sometimes in, like, the workshops. I'm like, here are two videos. You tell me which one you want to listen to. You tell me which one you remember in 5 minutes. And it's like that kind of thing. It's like almost an aha moment for a lot of people, where they really get it just by seeing the difference.
Absolutely. I think that's such an interesting point about, yeah, people want to connect and want to understand others. And I think that's also something that hopefully good journalism does really well as well, right? It connects us to other people, gives a greater understanding or empathy or just awareness of other people or people different from ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Could you give an example of maybe a time that you encountered an ethical dilemma, and how did you work through that? How did you deal with that?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One of the things I advocate for and I try to do myself is always try to reassess my own internal biases and how things I would have done before and now. And it might be trite to say, but as a mother, I also feel like I'm more vulnerable to seeing things in a good way, like, you know, more emotionally attached, whereas before I would have said my camera in front of my face is like a barrier and I don't feel the same things. So just thinking about this stuff and how I'm evolving, like, for example, I try not to say subject anymore, but participant. And like, also like something which is weird, but it, maybe it's just me, but when I would say go in the field, but like we're going to people's communities. So what is that? Like, it's the field for us, but it's not for them. So I say now going to communities or working outside or, you know, working on the ground, like this kind of thing, like instead of just trying to make it an other, making them equal and just thinking about that stuff. So I had an assignment. Again, I won't mention the newspaper, but it was not the New York Times. It was something else. And it was about circumcision in Turkey. And the family had consented to us taking a, in Turkey, boys are circumcised later. They're not necessarily circumcised at birth. And they had consented to me coming and photographing it. And I asked the photo editor what kind of photos they would want, because in the US, you know, they would not be graphic, right? And all this stuff. And I was aware like how much access I was going to get. And they just gave me access to the whole thing. And they were okay with me being there. Obviously, the child was traumatized, and that was traumatizing for me because also I have almost the same age child as watching the surgery aside, like just someone who's in pain, who's essentially like my child. But, you know, afterwards, I was thinking about this and I was like, this is not okay. Like, I sent a message and I said, you really need to explain in a lot more detail to the family, even though they gave consent, about what this means. And then they went back and forth and the family was like, oh, no, that's not no. And I was like, exactly. Like, I wouldn't want that. You wouldn't want that. Like, that's where we start from, right? And so I'd like to say that I would have done that 10 years ago. I don't know, you know, but I know now that in terms of the things that I've learned, like, so I deleted things and sent them the stuff that I thought was more appropriate. And that was a decision because it's also about that child. Right? Like, that's a trauma. Do you want to see that ever again? No. And so it was just one of those things where that was hard because, like, I knew that I wasn't sending all the stuff I could but that it wasn't right. And that was a couple of days going back and forth over my own head and like, what does this mean? And I'm still not sure exactly what I should have done, but I feel putting myself in the family's position, I know exactly how it would have felt. And so that was where I decided to draw the line.
Absolutely. I think you said something there that really struck me about how you don't know if that's what you would have done 10 years ago. You hope that you would have done something similar 10 years ago. But I think that that points at something that's super important that we tend to forget about, is that we are all evolving and we're all growing. And, you know, how you might handle that situation in another 10 years time might look again different. You know, I think that there's a real need to acknowledge that growth. And even, you know, you're describing the types of words that you're using now that you wouldn't have used or that you would have used previously, but that you're not using now, or the way that you're framing things differently. I think that that's so important to have people like yourself being really vulnerable about, well, these are the changes that I'm making, and this is what I used to do, and this is why that's not where I'm at anymore. That's not what feels good anymore. That's not, where the world is anymore, because the world's changing too, right?
Yeah, and I'm sure I'm going to make more mistakes and think about things in a different way, like you said. Like, because it's so important, the work that I do, I hope that just being genuine about this makes it clear that, like, anyone can make a mistake, including myself, in the future, in the past, whatever, and that I'm just learning from this as well. And that's okay. Like, we just have to face that and accept that, like, we're going to make these mistakes because we are human. And that's exactly the story we should be telling.
Absolutely. No, for sure. And yeah, I think, you know, thinking about that story that you shared as well, you know, thinking about consent, because of course, consent is only consent if people know what they're consenting to, right? And it sounds like in that story, there wasn't really an understanding of what it actually was that they were consenting to. And I guess I was wondering, can you talk a little bit more about, consent and how you handle that, especially with, you know, a lot of the maybe NGOs that you're working with?
That's a really, really good question, because I deal a lot with consent in also the trainings that I do. And also because, I mean, if you look at some of the consent forms, they're scary as F, right? I've signed them myself. Like, you are signing away your picture forever and this person can do whatever they want. And you're like, what? And I'm like able to read this and understand and ask for appropriate legal help if I want. And I'm going to give this to someone in a community that can barely, you know, understand all this legalese and expect them to be okay with this. Like, I've been advocating for better consent forms where people can retract consent and understand that their consent doesn't mean anything about whether they're going to get more or less services, you know, like this kind of thing. And of course, that's hard. Like, as you say, I can't retract the photos that I put out there, but you have to explain that and then also explain what you can do. You know, and that kind of stuff is like, it's a jungle, right? Like, there's so much out there. So it's a balance between verbal consent and written consent, and then assessing the situation too, because you might know something that they don't understand in terms of what that means. And so if that's something you have to kind of internalize and understand, NGOs, I think, have different policies about their consent and things like this. And it's evolving as well in terms of this stuff. I think, like, I've seen a couple of, for example, on ethicalstorytelling.com, they have a consent form, an example consent form that I like to use as an example. I have seen no one actually use this. And I mean, across the spectrum, right? So I'm talking, it's very broad, where it says, if I decide in 6 months or a year or whatever that I don't want my story or things have changed, I can say, don't use it, you know? And that scares lawyers, because they're like, how we deal with this. And I'm like, well, this is the conversation that you have to have. And there's no final answer. It's just that you have to also make them feel like this is the conversation and that there's nothing wrong with having this conversation. And then they get to decide.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that idea of flexibility and of giving people more choice, I think that that does scare people. You know, something that I would talk quite a bit about is the idea of sort of multi-layered consent, like giving people different options for how their photographs are used, you know? And I think there's this sort of flags go up in people's mind and they think, ooh, you know, that's impossible to manage, or it's impossible to, you know, but if captions can travel with a photograph, or if acknowledgement or consent forms can travel with a photograph, why can't people's preferences also travel with a photograph? Why is that the thing that is unmanageable? And it is funny. Do you think that that's the main, I guess, barrier for people in not using maybe consent forms that are a little bit more democratized, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word.
And then they could be held accountable for that, or things like that. And then, like, yes, you should. Like, you know, and that's the thing. Like, it's someone's life. That's their image that you've taken, or, you know, you're using their story. Like, that's the price of this. And that's really hard because, like, you know, we're talking about small organizations that don't have budgets, and big organizations that are too mammoth to, like, you know, and just like all of it, everyone has an excuse. And it's just a matter of, like I said, like, there's no right answer, but it's the conversation that's important, making people feel comfortable with what is presented to them. And then you understanding where that balance is too. So yeah, again, it's a very gray area, and that's frustrating, but I think that's the right path.
One thing that you said there was how it's people's lives, right? It's a responsibility. And I think that that's the thing that gets lost a lot of times, is that if we are the ones taking the photographs and using the photographs and storing the photographs, like, there are inherent responsibilities in that process. And I think that that sort of duty of care gets lost somewhere along the way, because frankly, I think there's quite a lot of bad practice, not necessarily because people are bad or intending bad, but just a lot of lack of awareness about these things. And I think that other people then think, well, why should we hold ourselves to a higher standard? If we're trying to compete in this market, you know, why should we be the ones to cuff our own hands?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. And like how, you know, a freelance photographer who needs to make a living can do all these things and can be as accountable as like a large organization or something like that is really scary. Like I said, it's just, that's why the conversation exists, but it's not a reason not to have it, you know? Then people start to get what that means. And the thing is, like, it's a check-in process too. I mean, like, I did those photos of the abortion project over 15 years ago. And then about 5 years after that, someone called me from a British magazine and wanted to publish some of them. I had gotten consent from all those ladies, but I felt like because of the issues, I wanted to make sure that 5 years on, that it was still okay. And one of the women said no, because she was at an organization where she didn't feel comfortable telling people, and she didn't want it out there. So I said, fine. And then recently she's changed organizations, and she contacted me to say, you know, if you do want to use it, please go ahead. Like, I left that organization and I now feel very comfortable talking about this. And that's kind of the path. It's like, you take it on yourself too. So I, you know, I told the magazine, no, you can have another person who feels comfortable with talking about this now, but not that particular photo. And of course the photo is out there because they knew about it, right? But it's like the republishing of it and giving it more press and things like that was going to bring it to the forefront for this woman again. And it wasn't a trauma for her. It was just something she didn't want to talk about. But what if it's a trauma for someone, or, you know, there's something else happened, or there's a lot of things that can endanger people.
I think that's such a good point that, well, a couple things, you know, one that, yeah, it's that ongoing conversation, that ongoing reassessment. But also I have heard it said sort of, you know, well, the cat's out of the bag, so you can't put it back in. But I think that the point you made there is vital, you know, that republishing it does heighten it. You know, of course it can be found. Of course it's already out there, but it's another act, it's another action to then reuse it again.
Totally.
And something that I like to ask everyone is, what does photography ethics mean to you?
I mean, to me, it's just humanity. You're being allowed to take a picture of someone and their life, and that's an honor to be able to do that. And I think about that all the time, about the things I've been able to do and how amazing it's been, and how people let me into their homes with my camera. And to me, it's not photo ethics, it's just how you want to be treated. That is just human. We just all have the human rights, and it's ethical because it's the way that if we want someone to gladden our home and then they do something that doesn't feel good, you put yourself in that person's shoes, how does that feel? And I think that's kind of like what I've misstepped on that and been told those exact words. And I'm like, you're right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, one of the first things I ever did in photography, because like, again, I went to school for engineering and I took photo courses, but they were like part of a major. I did a, never forget this, a class in the International School of Photography in New York City with this photographer, Andre Lambertson. And he put you in three situations that were uncomfortable in order to make you feel something about this. And one was like, go take a week and spend in a community and do things, right? So you have to get into the community. You can't just take a photo and leave. Second one was pair up with someone in the class and photograph each other naked. That was like crazy, right? Because you're like putting yourself really out there. And the third one was the one that really struck me was about find someone, random person on the street, and ask them to take a picture of them in their house. And this was way before I was a professional, right? So I spent like a week, like just randomly stalking people in like coffee shops, being like, maybe that person. And it was like so awkward and I felt so bad. And I finally found this woman and she was lovely. And like, she was from the neighborhood that I was from. So like, turns out we had some other connections and it was fine. But I always hold that with me, even now, where I'm like, that was weird. It's weird to be able to do this. I might be used to it, but it's weird that I can just say, can I go home with you and take a picture of you in your house for this story, right? And that people let me do that. Like, I just always hold that in terms of like, would I do that, you know? And just making sure that that's, yes, is the ethics behind that.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Photo Ethics Podcast. The aim of this podcast is to share new insights about photography ethics with others. So if you heard something you liked, please share this podcast with someone who would appreciate it. The links to all things mentioned in this episode are available in the show notes at www.photoethics.org. Join me next week when we hear from Anne Wackalore on reading and research. In each episode of the podcast, we ask our guests, what does photography ethics mean to you? This is a question that everyone in the photography industry should be able to answer. That's why the Photography Ethics Center is asking you, our listeners, to commit to writing and publishing your own statement of ethics. Visit www.photoethics.org/ethics to learn more and to make the pledge committing to ethical transparency, accountability, and awareness. That's www.photoethics.org/ethics. This podcast was edited and digitally produced by Ellie Gascoigne.